Nick, 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 Nick,
Nickelodeon!
From Nickelodeon Studios in Burbank, California, this is the Nickelodeon Animation Podcast. Hi, I'm your host, Hector Navarro. Welcome to the podcast. My guest today is a writer, director, storyboard artist, layout artist, and animator known for creating My Life as a Teenage Robot for Nickelodeon. He also directed episodes of Dexter's Laboratory, The Powerpuff Girls. He was the story editor for My Little Pony, Friendship is Magic, and he was the supervising producer on Gravity Falls. With a resume like that, it's no surprise that a following has been amassed around our guest, Mr. Rob Renzetti.
Look at you, right?
I don't have to look at the mic like this. You can look wherever you want, Rob. As long as
I'll
you
look
can.
Away.
Okay, great.
I don't like to make eye contact with the people I'm talking to.
I understand. That makes a lot of sense. What was the first memory that you have of animation? What did you love as a kid growing up?
Well, let's see. How far should I go back? Let's go back all the way to the beginning, which is me as a young kid liking to play with paper dolls, which seems kind of a strange way to start, but I would have coloring books and I would like the pictures in the coloring books, and I would ask my mother to replicate the pictures in the coloring books so that I could, I don't remember if I colored them before she'd cut them out or she'd cut them out and I'd color them, but then I would play with them as if they were figurines. And I did this so much that my mother eventually got tired of it and said, why don't you, you know, mimic the drawings yourself?
Yeah.
So that's how I started drawing. As far as how that hooked into cartoons, obviously, I think that, you know, they were cartoony coloring books. And eventually, I started seeing cartoons on TV. When I grew up, your access to cartoons was incredibly limited. There was no cable.
Yeah.
It was just whatever your local stations wanted to play. But luckily, I lived in Chicago or the Chicago suburbs, and I saw Popeye. I saw all the old Hanna-Barbera stuff. Occasionally, I saw the 60s Felix the Cat. I saw Warner Brothers. The one thing you didn't see, Disney. Disney didn't hardly ever appear. They were like very precious, those cartoons.
Just
they,
theatrical. Just Yeah,
they come out every 7 years and, and that would be it. So, I mean, I just had a love of cartoons since I was a little kid. And I started drawing since I was a little kid. And I think the two just always kind of, I knew that you could make a career out of it. And I kind of always had that as my goal, even from a very young age.
You went to Columbia College, Chicago.
I did. Well, first I went to University of Illinois in downstate.
University of Illinois.
Champaign-Urbana. And I graduated after 4 years with an art history degree.
Cool.
Because despite my intention of getting in the graphic design program, I didn't get in. There were like, I don't know, 100 art. You were all general art majors the first year.
Sure.
And then everybody got divvied up. And only about, everybody wanted to get into graphic design because it was the only thing that had practical, had any chance of making money when you're out of school. Instead, as opposed to being a painter or whatever, where it's like, you know, that's a real gamble. So I became an art history major because I enjoyed my first year art history class.
Sure.
And by the time I was done with that, I knew I didn't want to do art history.
How come? Why not?
It was not enjoyable. It was, you know, there's a lot of BS in a lot of professions, but art history, art history criticism is almost entirely BS. Like,
yeah.
It's all just like, oh, I see this, I see that. And I knew how to do it. I did well in my classes. I could BS as well as anybody else, but I didn't really feel like doing that the rest of my life. So my last year, actually, as I was graduating, I found out about CalArts out in California. And the second half of my senior year, taking The Illusion of Life, I basically made my first animated film.
Wow.
Because I was told by somebody who I knew who had already gone to the school, hey, they like to see animated films.
Mm-hmm.
It was shot by my roommate at the time, who was a film major on 8mm. And it was crappy animation, first of all, but it was also a crappy filmed version of crappy animation. I didn't get in that year. The following year, I'd found out through the same roommate that one of our old roommates' younger brothers was going to an animation program in Chicago.
Cool.
And that I could get in at the last minute. So I did.
Cool.
And that led that person who was also in that animation program was Genndy Tartakovsky. And I had been roommates with his older brother, and we saw each other. We both coincidentally took the same figure drawing class at Columbia, and we recognized each other because we'd met once, and we're like, wait, aren't you Alex's brother? Yeah, weren't you his roommate? And we became friends, and we were just like inseparable. And then the next year we both applied to CalArts again. I applied for a second time, and we both got in, and we came out to California together.
What is it you guys have in common that you were able to bond?
Well, I mean, we both loved animation, obviously. Yeah. And even though we were in a film program at Columbia, and there was an animation, you know, minor within the film, so I was an animation student for the first time, mm-hmm. there were other people around. The fact that we kind of pre-knew each other, and also we just both had the same kind of passion for it. We would spend... we had a teacher, Stan, who like had a bunch of like old Warner Brothers films on 16mm.
Cool.
And we could examine them frame by frame and see how they did stuff.
That's amazing.
So we both had that kind of passion. We had one other friend there, Darren, who had kind of shared our passion. The three of us kind of all were fanatic about this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So it was really about enthusiasm and level of enthusiasm. Once we got to CalArts, we both knew our draftsmanship was not as good as most of the people around us.
Sure.
And we were going to have to work hard, and we were, you know, we kind of have that Midwest spirit of like, you put your nose to the grindstone and you work.
What was that like for you as an artist looking at other artists who, I know that I've had this feeling of, mm-hmm. like, oh my gosh, they're blowing me away. I could never do that particular right. thing. Were you guys just honing in on your strengths? What did you feel like your strengths were? What was your sort of game plan when you made that decision?
I don't know
decision?
If I ever had a game plan. I could pretend that I did. I mean, when you're looking at people, Craig McCracken was one of them. Mm-hmm. We met him at CalArts, but that's just one example of people that seemed like they were naturals.
Yeah.
They just could draw really well right off the bat. A lot of those people, not Craig, but a lot of those people, because it comes easily to them, because they don't have to work at it, they kind of take it for granted, and they think because that came easily to them, the things that would follow, you know, good positions on a show,
yeah.
can, you know, climbing the ladder, all that should come easily as well.
Right.
And I've seen, you know, I've been in this industry a long time now, I've seen lots of talented people that don't do well because they think they shouldn't just need to, you know, sit back and it will come to them.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I've seen people that have worked really hard too, and they haven't gotten anywhere as well. So there's obviously a large element of luck
yeah.
and timing yes. in anyone's successful career. But because Gendy and I were not as great at drawing as everybody else around us at that point, we knew if we're going to be even getting close to do well, we're going to have to work hard, and we're going to have to work harder than the people that can do well. The best thing you can do is to rate yourself against yourself. If you are getting better and you are improving, then you're doing what you need to do.
Absolutely.
It's funny because now there is a generation of people that come out of school with the goal of having their own show. When Craig and Gendy and me were at CalArts in our class, that was not a goal that you had. And we were lucky to come out at the time when it did start happening. And
absolutely.
We were all able to eventually do it. When we were leaving CalArts, there was a couple of opportunities. One was connected to Hanna-Barbera. It was, I don't know if it was Turner Feature. Yeah, it was Turner Feature. Okay,
yeah.
Turner Feature was the name of the people that were making a movie called Pagemaster. They needed a bunch of new people
sure.
right when my class was getting ready to graduate. So mm-hmm. they brought us to, I think it's Bruce, I can't remember, Bruce Smith, I think it was one of the lead animators on it.
Yeah.
They brought us to his house. They had a bunch of artwork up from the movie, both in his house and in his yard. And he had this beautiful house with this professionally made treehouse in the backyard. And he's
wow.
like, look, I'm an animator. This is come into my world, and you may have this kind of life yourself someday.
Yeah.
And so Pagemaster like vacuumed up most of my graduating class to be like assistants and what cleanup
sure.
artists and stuff on
sure.
that feature. And Gendy and I, and I think even Craig, also had an offer to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So that was one thing we could do. At the same time, there's a guy named Sergio Pablos, who is a relatively famous Spanish animator and mm-hmm. Was one of the guys behind Despicable Me. He was in our class at CalArts. He'd come from Madrid to go to CalArts to learn. He was one of those people that could draw like amazing. Like,
yeah.
He was not only a good draftsman and could draw great characters, he could animate well, which
yeah.
is not always the same thing. We went away our freshman year. We came back. And after we came back, he said, hey, I'd worked for this company over the summer in Madrid.
Mm-hmm.
And this summer, they want to see if they can get some American animators to come over because they're going to have a few episodes of Batman the Animated Series.
Whoa.
Which was being done everywhere all over the world. They were
yeah.
trying to get that show done as quickly as possible. So they farmed out episodes to everybody. And so Sergio, Gendy and I decided instead of going to Pagemaster, where we would be cleaning up or maybe assistant
sure.
animating at the best eventually,
sure.
we could be animators in Spain and actually animate. On Batman, who we love. What a great character.
That's a pretty good pitch. I was going to say, how do you top the pitch that you described where you go to the house and you see the whole thing and you see Pagemaster and, you know, come and see this. I think that Spain is a pretty good topper.
I mean, it was a good opportunity. It didn't turn out to be a great experience because we didn't realize that the company that we were working for was going bankrupt.
Oh.
And they hadn't paid their Spanish animators in about a year. We got suspicious when we got there and we were promised, like, you'll have an apartment. Well, we were living in a hotel for 2 months.
Oh, no.
Not in just a hotel, but all in one room in a hotel.
Oh,
four
boy.
Of us. And we were supposed to get X amount of dollars or pesos a month or a week. And every time we'd ask for our salary, they'd be like, well, how much do you need this week?
Yeah.
And they'd give us as little as they possibly could.
You mentioned that you were at Hanna-Barbera. Was that the opportunity that came up? Guys went over to Hanna-Barbera?
I went after Spain. I kind of went back to Chicago and licked my wounds for a couple of months.
Sure.
And then Gendy and I both came back out to L.A. And Craig got hired to be the art director on this Two Stupid Dogs section. And then Craig knew Gendy and I, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And we got hired to be storyboard artists.
Great. What was that like? What was the feeling like for you guys to be there and to be on some of this stuff? Did you know that Hanna-Barbera was sort of coming back?
No, we had no idea.
No idea.
Hanna-Barbera had been doing a lot of bad animation for a while. There were a lot of talented people there, but they kind of had this kind of generation of people that come in there in the 70s, and then that was kind of it. There hadn't been an influx of new blood for close to 20 years.
Sure.
So when we all kind of came in, we were kind of looked askance at. To most people's credit, most of the old timers, they saw that we loved the craft and that we loved animation and that the shows we were doing were good.
Yeah.
They embraced us pretty quickly. There were always a few holdouts that were kind of like, hey, you're young, I don't like you. That's it. You can't do anything to win me over. But most of the people, there were a lot of veterans there had worked on classic stuff that had been there so long
so
that they'd
cool.
worked on the classic Hanna-Barbera stuff.
That's awesome.
So it was kind of a thrill for us to be let loose in a place that had so much history and history that we admired. It's funny because they initially set us up in this kind of very large office space where we're all in that together, and it was right next to Fred Seibert's office, who was the president of the company at the time. And Joe Barbera's office was next to his. So for some reason, we had Joe Barbera, animation legend, Fred Seibert, legend to be, and then us motley crew of 20-year-old jerks making a bunch of noise right next to the president of the company. Eventually, they decided we didn't belong there, and they put us in a trailer. Like, there was a trailer that was out back.
I heard about this trailer,
So we weren't even in a building with anybody else.
Tell us about the shorts. Was that a program that was up and running? Did you get involved there as well?
I eventually got involved, but when we first arrived, it was Two Stupid Dogs was Fred's first initiative.
Yeah.
Was just doing, like, giving a show to a young animator, kind of in the old school. And he was very inspired by John Crookfalusi, and John kind of had his ear at that point, and he told Fred, like, this is what you gotta do. You gotta find someone who's got an idea and let him make it. So that's what he did. And it wasn't a big success. It was it was put on TBS. It was put on weird times. It was shown in the early AM. Never really had a chance. And despite that, it actually did better than expected in the ratings. And that's why they did a second season.
Cool.
But the shorts program, Craig, that was kind of Fred's second initiative.
Yeah.
Which was, we're going to do a bunch of shorts and we'll see which ones are good. It was kind of like the opposite of I'm going to gamble. I'm going to put all my money on this one gamble, which was Two Stupid Dogs. And he's like, okay, for my second gamble, I'm not going to put all my money on one thing. I'm going to put my money on a bunch of different things.
Yeah. And that was the What a Cartoon.
That was
show.
What a Cartoon, yes.
Yeah.
And that was, Powerpuff came out of that.
Yeah.
Dexter came out of that.
Yeah.
And I did a short there. It was fun, interesting, because Dexter's and Powerpuff were both student films of Craig and Gendy. And my student film, which eventually wasn't called Mean and Account at the time, but the characters of Mean and Account were in my student film.
Cool.
And the reason I didn't jump on the shorts program right away, because they got in right away and got their short, was Terry Thorne, who is a guy who ran an animation festival, not Spike and Mike, but the more respectable festival that got put on here. He saw that as a student film and actually optioned it. From me, I want to make this into a show. So when the first Dexter short came out and the first Powerpuff short came out, I couldn't do a short yet because it was still legally tied up. So when it came back to me, I pitched it, and then that's the first and only short I did as part of What a Cartoon.
Where did the idea for Mean and the Count come from, and describe it to people in case they don't remember what it was or don't know what it is?
Sure. Okay. The short itself is about a little girl who befriends a vampire, or basically foists her friendship on a vampire.
Yeah.
who's coming into her room by mistake.
Mm-hmm. Thinking she's like an older woman.
Yes,
that
he thinks she's going to be 17 and instead she's 7. I don't remember. Something like that. She's a little girl. And Igor, his assistant, has screwed up his biting schedule. Basically, he's supposed to bite a new girl every night because he's a playboy vampire. Uh-huh. But this girl turns out to be a little girl. And she basically forces him to play with her and they become friends by the end of the cartoon.
Yeah.
Where the idea came from was when I was a kid, I was very much afraid of monsters.
Yeah.
Saw Dracula at a very young age. But for some reason, when I was young and having trouble getting sleep at night because I was afraid of monsters, I started conceiving of the idea that, and this was mostly, it had to do with the Frankenstein monster because I knew he had a vulnerability, like he liked kids.
Yes.
So I remember like, well, Frankenstein came into my room, I would just befriend him because he's a sad monster and he wants friends. So I'll be safe. If he comes in, I'll just befriend him and we'll become friends. And I like, this was something that I thought about a lot when I got scared of the idea of monsters. Like, I would think I would get myself into this thought pattern and it would soothe me and I would get to sleep.
My Best Friend by Nina Harper. My best friend has blue skin and is around 700 years old. We met one night when he flew into my house. He can change himself into a bat and fly wherever he likes. He can also change himself into a puff of smoke or a wolf. That is why he is my best friend. The end.
Thank you, Mina. That was very imaginative.
Where did the idea for teenage robot come from? Because the first short was my neighbor was a teenage robot, right? And then it became my life as a teenage robot.
Sure.
Where did the conception for this come from?
Well, after I lost that last Mina in the Count slot, and mm-hmm. Fred said, I want you to come up with something else. I started brainstorming ideas. And one idea I had was a teenage girl that had a robot for a boyfriend. Mm-hmm. And the idea there was that she would have all the angst and all the emotion of a teenage girl, and she would be funneling into this emotionless dead machine that didn't have any of these feelings for her, was just a pleasant robot that was happy to interact with her but didn't really feel anything for her.
Yeah.
But she would just project all these feelings onto him and think they were in this incredibly romantic relationship.
It kind of Pepe Le Pew vibe a little bit.
Yeah, I guess so.
It's like a one-sided.
Well, anyways, I pitched my three ideas to Fred and I pitched that one. And he said, I don't think that after you've just come off a show where a little girl has a relationship with a vampire that you want to have a teenage girl have a relationship with a robot. I don't think that's going to go over with the execs.
Yeah.
I'm like, oh, well, you're probably right. And then I was just driving somewhere randomly to the supermarket or whatever and thinking about the ideas and how they'd gotten rejected. And I thought, like, well, what if the robot was the teenage girl? What if those were the same character? And then with that thought, literally, the whole storyline of the initial pilot came falling out of my head.
Yeah.
Like within minutes, it just came out. I had to stop. I had to start writing stuff down on a piece of scrap of paper in my car and just make sure I didn't lose it. But I basically had most of it within 10 minutes, that pilot. Like I had it all figured out. Like, okay, this is what it's going to be.
Awesome.
And as far as the title change, it was really just like, she's going to be the protagonist. You know, she's going to be the star. It's going to be from her perspective.
Yeah, her life. Yeah.
The pilot was called My Neighbor Was a Teenage Robot, just because of the way we start with the Tuck, kind of discovering her. And also it felt very much like a 1950s horror movie, you know, title that way.
What were some of the visual influences for My Life as a Teenage Robot?
The first thing was kind of UPA cartoons from that era.
Mm-hmm.
Really always loved that design sensibility. And that was for the show. If you look at the short is very anime influenced.
Yeah.
Because it was done in like 1999. And anime hadn't really hit big yet here, but it was here. Alex Kerwin, who helped me design the short and eventually became my art director on the show, was a big fan of that kind of stuff. And I was more of a mini fan, but I liked that idea. I liked the idea of that style. Like, all the shorts I did as part of Oh Yeah Cartoons, I kind of tried to, I never have had really like an established house style. Like, this is what my stuff looks like.
Mm-hmm.
There's some things you can point to, but I wanted to vary the style of the stuff I was doing. So the first four shorts I did all kind of looked different. Mean Then Count had its own look, and it was very heavily UPA influenced as well. And then when Teenage Robot happened, if we did the pilot, it was anime. By the time the show got picked up in 2002, anime had kind of been like, everybody was doing anime influenced stuff now.
Yeah.
And I didn't really want to do that. I wanted it to stand out more than that.
Yeah.
And along with the UPA influence, we also, you know, Alex and I both loved 1930s cartoons a lot.
Yes.
And that kind of rubber hosey kind of thing. But I didn't want to do like just a straight like 30s look. I wanted to take some of that, but make it a little more sophisticated than that. Mm-hmm. And really it was the two of us working together, but especially Alex had the idea that we'll look at other things from the 1930s, like 1930s poster art.
Ooh, cool.
Which is very, it's stylized in the same kind of way that UPA stuff from the 50s is, and it's like flat planes of color.
Yeah.
You know, like very reduced details, things that are kind of abstracted into kind of an iconic version of themselves. So that's what those were kind of our touchstones. You know, the UPA thing had been very heavy in Meaning Account, and that kind of, we were going to still go that flat designy sensibility, but we mm-hmm. wanted to bring something else into it. And really that was the key to unlocking the look of the show, is that kind of looking at poster art from 1930s. You can see that reflected in the BG style on the show a lot.
Totally.
The characters, you know, the characters are kind of a combination of kind of rubber hose and you know, 1950s flat design, and with some anime, like old school anime influence,
yeah.
like, you know, from Astro Boy and stuff. Like, Alex was a huge fan of Astro Boy. I'd only seen a little bit of it, but like all their crazy, wacky hairdos that everybody has, that's directly lifted from the Astro Boy
that's
stuff.
Great.
You know, everybody should have some kind of strange, iconic, weird hair design.
It seems that some young robot has forgotten the rules of this household. You were built for one purpose, to protect the planet Earth. Unless you're out saving the world, you should stay in your room. You must avoid unnecessary contact with the human population, especially teenagers. Do I make myself clear, X-Janion?
Jenny.
What?
Jenny! Call me Jenny! I changed my name to Jenny, remember?
Up to this point in my animation career, I've been working on other people's stuff, and now this is my thing. Did you have any thoughts like that, or were you just kind of like, great, this is another great collaborative thing that I'm going to undertake?
Well, yeah, I mean, I'd wanted my own show for a while. I mean, I wanted Meaning Account to be a show.
Yeah.
I wouldn't have done, you know, what amounted to six shorts with it if I didn't think it had legs. Mm-hmm. One of the reasons I left Hanna-Barbera's when Fred was trying to lure me, he said, I want to make Meaning Account as a show. I think it could be a great show.
Mm-hmm.
It actually was up to be the middle show on Dexter at one point, but it didn't happen. Instead, they did the Justice Friends. So I would have been very happy if it had been a middle show on Dexter, but that didn't happen.
Yeah.
So Fred kind of lured me over here with the idea of like, that would be my show. So like I had the idea in my head that I wanted my own show for a long time, but Mina didn't work out. Teenage Robot did. I was glad because I was like, well, there's lots of legs to this. There's legs to this idea. This can be a show as well. This is probably the next thing that I did as a short that I was like, yeah, this is really a show. There's enough here to dig into. As far as like, you know, it's very overwhelming. Once you get your first show, you're like, okay, how the hell am I going to do it? You know, so luckily, like I said, Alex was kind of like, I knew Alex was going to be my art director. I hope he'd be my art director. I hope he said yes. But mm-hmm. like there was nobody else I had in mind for my art director. And like he was the first person I hired, and we talked, you know, we got into development and started working on it right away. So from right away, it was very collaborative. Again, Alex is a much better draftsman, a much better artist than I am. And I wanted him to be in charge of the way the show looked.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we came up with the look together, but like I give him the lion's share of the credit of like actually being able to execute how we wanted it to look.
Yeah.
Two other key players I should mention on the show are Joseph Holt, who was my lead BG designer,
mm-hmm.
and Sana Hong, who was my lead BG painter. Those two actually executed what we wanted to do in terms of the background styling and all that. So it was, of course, it was collaborative from the get-go. But as the creator of the show, you are swallowed by your show. You know, I mean, it swallows your life. There was a good 2-year period where I was working 7 days a week, with maybe, you know, I'd take off holidays.
Sure.
I'd take off Christmas, maybe take off a couple of days of Christmas.
Yeah.
That was it. You know, I was here all the time. And luckily for me, I had been married for a while.
So that's stable.
You know, right? Like we were happy together, and my wife knew what this was going to take.
Yeah.
And, you know, she put up with it for, you know, the run of the show. It got better. You know, eventually I wasn't working that much. But the hardest thing about a show when you start it is that it's only in your head. And as no matter how much you talk about it, no matter how many Bible pages you write,
mm-hmm.
or how many drawings you do of the characters that are cute, until you start executing and do episodes and actually get episodes completed,
mm-hmm.
it's very hard for anybody else to see what it's supposed to be. Now I was lucky because I had Alex, and then, you know, Alex really, I was lucky. I had one other person that was on the same wavelength of me,
yeah,
and he knew what I wanted the show to look like. But only really I knew what I wanted the show to be like in terms of the sensibility and the humor and the pacing and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And eventually I assembled a team where they could look back at episodes that were done and say, okay, that's what we're shooting for. But when you first get it, when you first, you know, first have it, it's like, it's just in your head.
Yeah.
And nobody else knows what it's going to be like. And every time a little bit comes out that's incomplete, it's just an opportunity for people to go, I don't think that's going to be good. And you're like, no, it'll be good.
Yeah.
let me get it finished before you judge it. Especially on my show, there was always at least one action sequence, which was like, didn't have a lot of dialogue.
Sure.
And, you know, the work prints would come back from overseas and the execs would be kind of like flummoxed about that because they'd be like, I don't know, this part seems really dead. I'm like, that's because there's no dialogue and the music and sound effects haven't been put in yet.
Exactly.
And eventually, once I got the first few episodes completed, the execs were like, hey, you know what? The show is really good. It works. And I'm like... Yeah, I know. I'm glad you can see it now. But yes, that's what we always intended for it to be good. We didn't intend for it to be slow and to have sections that were quiet and boring. But yeah, that's the hardest part, is just birthing it from your mind into the world. You say if you were given more time, it could be better, which is probably the case to a certain extent. But eventually, like, you get too much time, then you're just wallowing in indecisiveness.
Exactly.
You need schedules and pressure to get it done.
But you never finish, you walk away. You never finish.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's just, you just had one point is like, okay, it's already a week overdue. I got to get it out the door.
What has the response been like to see people who come up and go, I loved My Life as a Teenage Robot?
Well, I mean, it's very gratifying, you know, now that it's 10 years later, that there's a lot of people that are old enough, people that I work with that are old, you know, old enough now to be like, I grew up with your show. I loved it. And that's great. It's great to hear that. it's funny because when our show was coming out, the internet was just kind of blossoming, and we had a show blog called the Teenage Row Blog that we kept up for the run of the show.
That's
and
a people great name.
Really, people appreciated it. You know, I would read a little bit of fan feedback, but I tried to keep away from too much of that because I didn't want to. It's interesting because I think the feeling now is very much opposite, that they were interested in fan feedback and they allow it to influence themselves. But I didn't really want it to influence what I was doing with the show. One, I didn't want to have people say, your show sucks, change it. Or, you know, I love this, do this all the time. I didn't want that, however much I might resist it, to permeate my thinking.
Sure.
So I didn't look at a lot of fan feedback and I didn't look at any fan fiction. I never wanted to be accused of stealing a story from a fan.
Right.
And I still haven't really looked at a lot of fan fiction, even though the show's over with. But it's interesting to see, since it's been over, there still is a rabid core of fans that still are interested in the show.
Yeah.
There's a group of fans that are trying to get fan-made episodes done.
Really?
Yeah.
That's incredible.
Yes.
Wow.
So that's happening. I check on them every once in a while. It's very slow going, but they're supposedly writing episodes and recording voices and whatever. So it's an interesting thing that I wouldn't have predicted happening.
You also worked on My Little Pony Friendship is Magic.
Mm-hmm.
Where were you when you first heard the word brony?
I was already off the show. There was
really?
Kind of a delayed response. Well, you know, that show was made very quickly.
Yeah. And you were the story editor for the first two seasons.
For the first two seasons, which was 52 half hours.
Yeah.
It was basically a full run of a normal show. But yeah, I was a story editor for the first two seasons. I guess you could say I was maybe the first brony. You know, Lauren approached me and told me about the show. And all I had seen is the very crappy stuff that had been done with My Little Pony before that. But she told me what she wanted to do, and I was really sold on her concept of the characters and very excited about the idea of six lead female characters that were all distinctive and different and not just the girl. So it was really exciting. I was really happy to be a part of it. And then it kind of started to pick up after Lauren and I left. She didn't want to do the show anymore, and I wasn't going to do it without her. So I left and moved to Disney, and then kind of that phenomenon kind of really started taking off. There were rumblings of it, but not much.
When you were at Disney and you're looking over and you're seeing that fan, what was your take on it? What did you think of that?
I mean, it was really flabbergasting. I don't know. It wasn't something we expected. I thought we'd always have adult fans of the show because we weren't trying to write it down to little kids. We're writing it for ourselves. PG rated stuff that we thought was funny. So I thought, well, you know, any show that we've made and that I've made, I hope has always had adult fans when it's come out, not just kids that watch it now are still fans as adults. So I thought we'd have an adult fans. I just didn't think we'd have the brony phenomenon.
Yeah.
But I couldn't see that coming.
So let's talk about seeing the response to Gravity Falls. Has that been a gratifying experience?
It's been really gratifying. I mean, one of the reasons I wanted to work on Gravity Falls is that because Up until that point, I'd never been on a show where we were allowed to do continuity. I tried to get a little bit in, a very little bit in.
Yeah.
And there's a little bit in there.
What do you think changed? What do you think changed
anime,
in animation?
Anime changed. And wow. the way anime kind of permeated our culture.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, continuity is king in anime. I mean, most mm-hmm. of those shows all are going somewhere.
Yeah.
They have a beginning, middle, and end.
Yeah.
And there's a great generation of kids that not only grew up liking that, but expecting that. So that was a real big allure for me.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea that we just did a little bit of that, kind of a minimal in season one.
Yeah.
And fans hooked into it. Like that, by this point, like looking at fan responses, kind of like that's what you do. You just see what the fans are thinking of
yep.
it. So from day one, we were looking at fan response and seeing how they are responding to things and knowing that like, okay, they really are loving the mystery, the big mystery that is embedded in the show. They love that. Anytime we give them any of those breadcrumbs,
yeah.
they just eat it up.
Yeah.
They're just so hungry and they're like extrapolating and making like, it's going to go this way. It's got everybody had a million theories, like what's going to happen? How's it going to end? You know, yeah. all that kind of stuff. So, it's really gratifying to see that that's a thing that you can do and that people respond to.
Mm-hmm.
Some fans, from the little hints that we had dropped in season one, there was some fan online that had basically figured the whole thing out.
Wow.
And we were like, what are we going to do?
Yeah.
None of us wanted to do the Lost thing where it purportedly like people figured out the ending. So they had to change it up and make mm-hmm. it crappier because people knew what they were going to do. So what Alex came up with is we decided to fake an image of McGucket, who's this old hillbilly character in the show, being the author of the journal.
Yeah.
Like we drew an image of him writing in the journal. We
you put it jerks.
We did this all in like a couple of days. And this is Alex Hirsch's idea. This is why he's brilliant, because he knew how to play the fans like a Stradivarius.
Yeah.
So we put it up on the screen in our editor's bay,
mm-hmm.
and I took my iPhone like from the hallway
mm-hmm.
and took a photo of it, like took a few different photos of it, and then Alex took the best one
mm-hmm.
that looked the most kind of like caught by somebody when they shouldn't be looking, seeing it,
yeah.
and threw it up on the internet, and then took it down, and then tweeted about like how he was so upset right now, vaguely, and then it became this just thing like, oh my God, did you see this, blah, 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 and it was enough to like, hey, look over here, that nobody picked up on the person that had figured out the whole goddamn show.
Rob, is there anything that you haven't had a chance to work on yet that is like a dream project of yours, something that you'd love to do?
I mean, I would like to eventually maybe work in features.
But
that hasn't happened. Briefly, before Gendy worked on a Popeye movie, Craig mm-hmm. and I were working on a Popeye movie at
cool.
Sony. But that didn't go anywhere.
Yeah.
Just like Gendy's didn't go anywhere. Mm-hmm. Like I said, Popeye's my favorite character, and working on a feature about Popeye would be a dream come true. But
yeah.
I don't know that they're ever going to get that off the ground. I don't know if I think Gendy would have done a great job with it.
Yeah.
And the little test that he did was fantastic.
We've seen it. So great.
Yeah.
So great.
But
yeah.
I don't know that they know what they've got there or that they want to do it right.
I know. I think it's time for Popeye to come back.
I love Popeye.
It's time. Yeah.
Love
yeah.
Popeye.
What is it about Popeye that you love so much?
Well, I was a wimpy little kid who I would be afraid of confronting anyone physically. So the idea that this weird-looking sailor, you know, could beat up anybody with his magical can of spinach was a real fantasy for me.
Did you download a lot of spinach?
No, I never touched spinach.
No.
I hated all vegetables as a kid. The only vegetable I ate was corn. I took no lessons from Popeye, no matter how much I admired him.
I guess it didn't work. I guess the lessons
Well,
didn't
you know,
work.
I don't know. I never tried it. I've eaten spinach as an adult. I don't think it has those effects.
Yeah.
But yeah, as a kid, I did not take that lesson to
that's
heart.
That's so funny. That's great. Well, that's awesome. Rob, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Sure,
this
was a
fantastic.
Pleasure.
This was fantastic.
It was a pleasure talking with you.
Well, there it is, everybody. Our conversation with Mr. Rob Renzetti. I'm a longtime fan. Guys, thank you so much for continuing to like and share the podcast. If you want, wherever you're getting your podcast from, go ahead and leave a review because it helps us out. Also, don't forget to go to nickanimationpodcast.com for a bunch of cool, awesome, extra behind-the-scenes stuff, including some material from my life as a teenage robot. Thanks to the awesome crew who puts this podcast together. This podcast is produced by
Jonathan Highlander,
Dana Vasquez-Eberhardt, Kelly Smith,
Andrew Huebner.
Original music by Useful Creatures. This week's episode edited by
Josh Caldwell,
Jonathan Highlander.
All of the incredible social media for our podcast is made by
Narve Manassians,
Sammy Armiger,
David Watson.
And thanks to the man who works at controls and makes me sound better than I have a right to,
Manny Grava.
Until next time, thanks for listening to the Nickelodeon Animation Podcast, and keep watching cartoons.